Okay, I think I'll get started. So Paul, Ryan is here. He's visiting. He's a specialist in this new technology called, well, not new, but in this cutting edge technology called the quantum spectral curve, which is a tool that is basically the most advanced tool right now for computing the spectrum of N equals 4 super young meals and of other examples of ADS-CFT. And so I thought it would be great to take advantage of his visit and perhaps organize a small mini course where we will discuss what's then the state of the art concerning this quantum spectral curve technology, and also what are the open problems in related topics related to integrability and N equals 4 super young meals, such as, for example, how are we doing with respect to computing structure constants and correlation functions in this gauge theory in the planar limit? And that's more or less what I will do. So the plan for the course is I will start with a general overview, drawing a few nice pictures, and then I will finally, in the second half of today, write some sharp formulas for these structure constants and how do we compute them. Then Paul will introduce all this technology of the quantum spectral curve and what are these Q functions, Baxter equations, and so on, that I will mention a little bit. And then I will come back to the structure constants and ask if we could come up with a machine that takes these quantum, these solutions of the quantum spectral curve, three solutions, for example, one for each operator, and would give us a number that would be the structure constant for these three operators. Okay. So this is more or less the plan. Here are the three main references, I would say, for the part that I'm going to discuss. But let's keep it informal, and please ask questions as we go along. Okay, so the first thing I want to mention is that in this theory, we have particles. And in particular, we have what we call the physical particles. And they will appear in N equals 4 in a rather simple way. Suppose I have some local operator. So it would be trace. And I have a bunch of scalars of my theory, some complex scalar z's. And I have a bunch of them. And then I could have, say, a derivative. Or I could have, say, another complex scalar of the theory. Or I could have a fermion excitation, and so on. And the way we think of these operators in N equals 4 is that there is some vacuum. And on top of this vacuum, we have some disturbances, like these derivatives, that could be given some momentum, p1, and this guy some momentum, p2, and this one some momentum, p3. And these, they would be the excitations or the particles. Now, these particles in this operator, they are particles that move in this one-dimensional object. These particles are nothing but, this operator is nothing but the dual of a single string. You see, it's a single trace. So it's an object with some cyclicity. And then you think of this excitation as some bump on this string. And then there is another excitation here. And then there is another excitation here. And these are all different excitations, different polarizations that you can excite on the string. And you have some kind of closed string like this. And then these particles, these derivatives and x's or fermions, can move. And if this is time, if I draw time going like this, then these particles can move, and they can scatter with each other. And when they scatter, their interaction is governed by the S matrix of these excitations here, that I draw here, this S matrix, which is a very important tensor. If you take excitation of type A and excitation of type B, it could be a derivative and an X, you could scatter into an excitation of type C and an excitation of type D, and this you would scatter with some momentum, p1 and p2. So this is a beautiful and very important object in this theory. So this is an important, it's an important tensor. You take two indices, two excitations, you get two other excitations. And this tensor, this S matrix of these excitations, this object is known exactly. And Bizard wrote it down. I might write it down in the last lecture, some elements of it, but it's a very important building block. And it's a very important building block because the way these particles interact is that when many particles interact, for example, if I draw the line of the other particle, all these particles do is scatter in a sequence of pairwise events. So if you want to know how particles interact in n equals 4 in this planar limit, or how excitations of the string interact, all you need to know is how pairs of particles interact, and then you can decompose everything into interactions pair by pair. Now, so this describes excitations. Again, you can think of this as bumps of the string that are moving, or as magnon excitations, like you have a spin chain, and you have excitations that are moving. So they really move, so they are really physical, and so we call them physical particles. They are really some physical bumps. If you were to measure some energy density, you would really see some bumps moving, and they would be moving and scattering with each other, and they are physical. Now, what happens when we put these physical particles and let them move in time? So let me draw the string as some circle. It's a closed string, and it's some kind of circle. And then, as it moves in time, it draws a cylinder. And in this cylinder, we have these physical particles, right? And so we could have, as we said, these physical particles moving to the future, another physical particle moving. And when it moves, what happens when they move? They interact with each other, and we get this S matrix for the excitations of this particle with each other. Now, that's not the only thing that happens. If we are in here, other things that can happen is that we could have virtual particles here that wrap the cylinder and that interact with these physical particles. This would be the same type of quantum effects that determine Casimir energy. If you put two plates, then you have quantum effects that give some force between the plates. Or if you put any theory on a circle, we have some volume dependence on the energy of that circle, right? Even if it's empty. So what's going on is that we have these mirror particles, these quantum particles here. And this is another important player in the game, which is this mirror particle. And you see that the mirror particle moving around in the cylinder, it also interacts with the physical particle, right? And for example, if I had a single physical particle, I could have many of these mirror particles interacting with it. And this would give me what? It would correct the mass of my physical particle. My physical particle would be in the, by being in a finite volume, the mass is shifted and its energy level is shifted because of the interaction with all these quantum particles. Now, what is this interaction object here? This would be the same tensor that I had before, the same S matrix object. Now, between P and Q, where P is just the physical momentum of the particle, and this Q now would be the mirror momentum, being that these mirror particles are just weak rotations, which are just some kind of analytic continuation, where we flip the momentum and the energy. Oops. The momentum and the energy of my particles. So these particles, I can think of them, they are not new particles. They are the same particles weak rotated, where I swap what I call time and space. Now, if the theory is Lorentz invariant, when I swap time and space, I get the same theory, right? Because we have just a Lorentz invariant theory, so swapping time and space, I get the same theory. If the theory is not Lorentz invariant, I don't have a guarantee that this energy, that the dispersion relation that relates this energy with this momentum is the same as the original energy with the original momentum, but I can still rotate them to each other. I can still weak rotate. It is just that the theory might not be Lorentz invariant, and this is one example. And so we have this object that is the same tensor that we have here, where we take two arguments, and one of these arguments here, we do an analytic continuation and we rotate it. Right? Now, when we deal with particles, we think this rotation is just rotate by 90 degrees. Here it could be a slightly more complicated rotation. This continuation from physical to meter that flips time and space could be a little bit more complicated, and I'll tell you at the very end what exactly is the path of analytic continuation that implements this. It's a little bit more subtle, but it's not a new object. It's the same S that appears here between two physical particles, where one of the particles was analytically continued to become a mirror particle. What else could happen if I put the theory in finite volume? Well, I could have more mirror particles, like this, that would again interact with my physical particles. But now I get yet a new object here, which is these 2 meter particles can also scatter with each other. And now we would get an S matrix, the same S matrix object, but between two analytically continued momentum between 2 meter particles. And I'm just giving you again a schematic overview. I'm not hoping that you understand all the details of the formulae, but just to give you a physical picture. And the physical picture we get is that we have this finite circle. Time is not compact. Space is compact. And we have particles. Some of them are physical. Some of them are mirror particles. And all of them interact with each other. And the nice thing is that they only interact in pairs. The interaction when the pair meets is given by an object that we know completely. It's fixed. It's given by symmetry, and we know it exactly at any value of the coupling. And these interactions can be of different types, can be between physical particles, between physical particle and mirror particles, or purely between mirror particles.
So can't we expand the mirror particles in the physical particle basis? Is that because it should be a complete Hilbert space? Complete basis.
So the Hilbert space on the X and on the T are different. These are not the same Hilbert space. Like I said before, the physical particles here, they have some dispersion relation, some energy as function of the momentum. If I cut the space here instead, my mirror particles will have a different dispersion relation, a different relation between the energy and the momentum. Also, if I cut it here, the spectrum is discrete because I'm dealing in finite volume, and I have a sum over a discrete set of states. If I cut it here, this direction is infinite. I have an integral. I have a continuum set of states. So the physics cutting here and cutting here is rather different. One cut is an integral cut where I have a continuous spectrum because this line is infinite. One cut is a discrete cut where I have a finite sum over states.
But if you're in one Hilbert space, why would you need to change? Why would you need other contributions from a different Hilbert space if you're doing calculations in this finite space?
Because I'm using the notion of particles. If I were to use the notion of states, exact states, then you are right, of course, that an exact state is just an exact eigenstate of my Hamiltonian incorporating all contributions, physical, virtual, everything. And then I just have a bunch of well-designed eigenstates that I evolve with some energy. Then, of course, I just do evolution vertically, and I don't care about this. And indeed, yeah.
I get the impression that we started from some four-dimensional problem. You just seamlessly move to two-dimensional integrable field theory, or it's not important.
Right. So it was very fast indeed. So first, string theory. In string theory, we have a one dimension, which is just the string. Now, you are saying in the field theory was four-dimensional, and now suddenly I'm discussing one dimensions. That's because this is how we describe local operators. So you see that this operator has a bunch of fields. All of them are evaluated at the same four-dimensional point, x. this four-dimensional point is not playing an important role. It is just the same for all these fields. So it's, we are not looking at how points move in this four-dimensional space. We are looking at a single operator and looking inside the operator to see what it is made of. And then we see that operator looks more like, it's not really a point. It looks more like a string. It has a line structure. And it's a line structure because we just multiply matrices. So there is an order of the multiplication of matrices, and that's where the one dimension comes from.
And what is this two-dimensional momentum?
This momentum, it's a one-dimensional momentum, conjugates to the position where I put this excitation. So if I put an excitation at position n, I can parameterize the operator by where the excitation is or by what momentum the excitation has, by just going between position space and momentum space.
So for string of operators of finite length, this momentum would be discrete.
Very good. Yes, that's what I said. So indeed, the momentum will be discrete because this circle here will have some length, some finite length, L, or here there would be L fields, and therefore we will deal with a spin chain of length L, and therefore this momentum would be quantized. And I'll come back to this very, very soon.
Anti-periodical on this one, the fermion, the spin structure.
So here,
yes.
When I go around the space?
It seems that anti-periodic.
Yeah, the fermion would be anti-periodic. Yeah. Okay. Then we have this picture, and to make it a little bit more concrete, but I'm still in the overview part, so I'm not yet totally precise, but I will be soon. The energy of this string, we have these string states, and what's their energy? Okay, first let me recall that the energy is also the dimension of the corresponding operator, O. So that's a very important piece of the CFT data. It's what's the spectrum of this conformal field theory? Then what would it be? It would be the sum of the energies of the individual particles J, where this sum J is a sum over the physical particles that make the operator, plus the interactions with the mirror particles that I would write as an integral dQ with some interaction. Let me not be precise. Let's say there are n mirror particles, and I also sum over how many of them there are. And then these particles interact with my physical particles, pj, but there are also these mirror particles, qa. And there would be some integrand like this that I would have to compute. And so this would represent the energy of the various particles. It would be the approximate, it would be a good approximation if this circle is big. The circle is big, the energy of 10 particles is just the energy of each of the particles. But when the circle starts becoming smaller and smaller, the particles are tighter together, and these quantum effects are more important, and then I have this finite size Casimir-like energy corrections that I need to take into account. So these are suppressed when the length of the operator is big. Okay? Now, so this, there is a big program for understanding the spectrum that I'm not going to describe, but let me just say that these sums here, over all possible states, you start putting 1 meter particle, 2 meter particles, 3 meter particles, more and more meter particles correcting the energy of this state. Right? And this can be resummed. You can get rid completely of this sum. And when you resum this, you get what's called the thermodynamic Bittan-Zatz. And then it can be improved further and cast into a solution, into this quantum spectral curve that we will hear about. So the physical picture that we start is this one, but this quantum spectral curve is, if you want, a resummation of all the possible quantum effects in a way that automatically gives you the energy of these states in a way like Arish was saying. I don't care about different channels, I just want the various energy levels of my states. And then we will see that each this quantum spectral curve outputs these Baxter functions Q of U. And so giving an operator or a string in n equals 4 super Young-Mills, will be equivalent to solving a set of equations that give you this spectral, this Q function, and then the energy is some functional that takes the this Q function and spits out a number that will be the same as this number, but computed in a much more powerful way.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why doesn't S contribute to the Hamiltonian?
S, what is S? Ah, S here?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's inside this stuff here.
And if I want to think of this...
For example, the first mirror particle, this term is roughly a product of scattering of the mirror particle with all physical particles. And then I integrate that over the momentum of the mirror particle.
But you didn't have the term of the two physical particles clause.
No, because that will be included in the quantization of this momentum here. So this momentum here are quantized. And in this quantization, the scattering between two of these particles shows up. And that's what I'm going to tell in
my other question. Like in the spin chain language, is there an interpretation of the mirror particles in the spin chain point of view?
No.
No.
Not that I know. There is some attempts at constructing some transfer matrices that would evolve the spin chain, and then once you start stacking many transfer matrices, now suddenly you can change again what you call space and time. This gives some notion of swapping space and time. I don't think it's exactly the same notion. So that's a great question. How do I think of mirrored particles in spin chains? So here we are not dealing with a spin chain or with a relativistic theory. We are dealing with some hybrid thing in the middle. And so in this hybrid beast that we are dealing, we can do the best of both. So we can do weak rotations because it's a field theory, but we can think of some aspects because it's a spin chain. But that particular aspect of what's a mirror particle, it's very natural when I have a field theory. When I have a spin chain, it's an interesting problem. Yeah. So I don't think it's not.
So for a given length of the circle, what does the suppression in the length of the circle look like?
Okay, good. So the suppression, what do you expect it to be? You expect it to be exponential of minus the mass of the virtual particle times the length.
Times n as well?
The length of the spin chain. So for example, if I have 10 fields, e to the minus m times 10, where 10 is the length of this circle. Now I would have to tell what is the mass and what is the length. So the length I told you, in this spin chain case, for example, that I drew there, the length would be just a number of these z fields. It's just the size of the operator. M is the energy of these particles, of these virtual particles, at zero momentum. You could define the mass like that. So you take the energy of a particle, put it at rest, what's the energy? And that gives you an idea of the size of these corrections here.
So shouldn't it also be multiplied by n, small n?
Yeah. This is the minimum term. This is the smallest term that comes from n equal to 1.
Right, okay.
Two particles is much more suppressed. Right? So two virtual particles that go around some big circle is a much, much more suppressed effect than just one mirror particle. So the leading effect comes from when n is equal to 1, and it's of this order. Otherwise, you are right, with n particles, it's exactly what you said.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, so to conclude this overview, let me draw what is the cartoon formula for the structure constant. What formula do we have for the structure constant? So for the energy, I hope it's clear, we have energies of particles as if they were in infinite volume, modulo the statement that the momentum are quantized. If other than the momentum being quantized, it is just the energy of the particles as if they don't know about each other, plus some Casimir-like energy which couples the various particles and where the mirror particles interact with the physical ones. Okay.
So this L in the exponential, is that it's the number of excitations, right? Not the length of the spin chain? assuming that you would have to have an infinite number of sites and then finite excitations, which are L.
No. You have a finite number of sites.
Okay.
For example, 10 sites. Then this length is 10. Number of sites. We want to study finite operators in any cost part. I want to know the spectrum of the lowest operator. They have like 4, 6, 8. They don't have infinite length.
So is for, this formula in terms of this TBA and is it only valid for large n? Or is it?
Yeah. This is all planar. All I'm going to say is the leading order in the planar limit. Only in this planar limit do we have this one-dimensional picture.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not. We are not dealing with one string, it's a gas of strings, and we are not dealing with one trace, we are dealing with a gas of multi-traces. So here planarity is always, will always be assumed. Okay, so what's the picture? So this picture here, let me maybe draw just one more cartoon. If we think that this is the cylinder, you can say that what you did here is you had all these particles that were going around the cylinder, these virtual particles. And how do you detect them? You detect them, if you want, by cutting the cylinder. And this sum here and this integral are related to inserting the resolution of the identity here where you decided to cut the cylinder. And then you have your physical particles plus everything that flows here that you insert a complete base of states, and that gives you this sum and integral over everything. So what you can think of this formula is you had your cylinder, you decompactified the cylinder, and then you glued it back together. And this gave you the finite size spectrum. Now, when we are dealing with three-point functions, we are not dealing with a cylinder, we are dealing with a pair of pens. So the picture I have to draw is now that I have two strings merging into a third string. So I have a topology that's not a cylinder anymore, but is a pair of pens. And here, on my cylinder, I add some momentum, P1, P2. And now each operator can have some momentum. For example, this one could have 5 momentum, P of operator 1, J, where J runs from 1 to 5. There could be some other particles, let me use squares for this one, some 3 excitations on this operator. This would be momentum 2, J, where J runs from 1 to 3. And this one could have, say, 4 particles, let me use mobile. And this would be momentum J of the third operator, where J would run from 1 to 4. And now we would like to write a formula that takes these operators, each of them parameterized by its own set of momenta that will be quantized, as I'm going to describe soon, and get a number for it. In the same way that I have a formula that, given some set of momentum for this operator, I get a number which is the energy. Right? So that's what we are after. And the cartoon, let me tell you what it is, and then we see why it is not so surprising. It's the following. Instead of a single sum over physical particles, now we have 3 sums. And these are sums over partitions. These are sums over ways of breaking the set of momentum. I have this set of 5 momentum here. I want to break it into alpha and its complement. So I take each physical set of momentum and I sum over ways of breaking it into 2 partitions. Okay, for momentum 1, for momentum 2, and for momentum 3. Then, similarly to this integral over virtual particles, there are now 3 integrals over virtual particles. And by this integral, I mean integral and sum. Let me mean this thing here. So there will be 3 sets of integrals over Q. Let me call this Q12, over a set of virtual momentum Q13, and over a set of virtual momentum Q23. And then there is some integrand that schematically, let me write it as an hexagon, an object that we call the hexagon, and this will be an hexagon square, and this would be a function of all this momentum, all this physical momentum, P, A, J, where A is 1, 2, 3, and J is the number of excitations in each operator, and of all these meter particles, Q12, Q13, and Q23. Okay? And where would such formula come from? What's the intuition behind this formula? And the intuition is that now, when we have a pair of pens, when we have a cylinder, a nice way of describing a cylinder is a square with identification. How do we describe mathematically a pair of pens? A two-dimensional surface like a pair of pens. We cut it also, but not into squares, into hexagons. Okay. Actually, it's in Wikipedia. I saw. If you go to Wikipedia, pair of pens, it's written there. In mathematics, a pair of pens is a two-dimensional surface resembling a pair of pens. That's the first sentence. Second sentence. It can be obtained by stitching together two hexagons on every other edge. I did not know, but when I was looking for picture for a pair of pens, once we were writing the paper, I found that it was there, the solution. Okay, and so the idea is you now cut this pair of pens. And when you cut the pair of pens, you see what happens, that if you cut the pair of pens along the seams, there is these two shapes in the front, this one and this one here in the back, right? And the back shape that goes around. And each of them is an hexagon, right? If you count number of edges, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Right? So each of them is an hexagon. And so we have exactly an hexagon in the front. And we have here, this shape here, an hexagon in the back. Right? So it's exactly an hexagon in the front, glued together with an hexagon in the back. But now when we glue it, you see that we have to insert an identity here, an identity here, and an identity here. And that's why we have not just one, but three resolutions of the identity. Right? And there is one that if this is operator 2 and this is operator 3, this basis is the one I would associate with this momentum Q23. Right? Moreover, when we cut now this operator, we have to be careful. Because you see, there's a difference with respect to this. Here we cut, but after we cut, we get a square, and the particles are there in the bottom of the square. Right? But now, if we cut twice, we have to be careful. The particles can be in the front, or they can be in the back. Right? I have these particles moving around in my circle, and I go and cut the circle in two points. And some guys got trapped on this side, and some guys got trapped on the other side, right? And so what should I do? I should sum over who got stuck in the front and who got stuck in the back. And that's exactly what these sums do. So this alpha are the particles that got in the front, that stayed in the front, and this alpha bar in the back. So as I cut this, some particles are in the front, some particles are in the back. And so we end up with this picture that the three-point function is given by gluing two hexagons together. And we will see in the remaining, I will write a formula that will give an example of this formula showing up with all the factors and so on, so we see it really in practice how it looks. Okay, any question? So this is the overview, and now I will go to the serious part of the course where we'll write equations.
If we look in the gauge theory context, with these traces, is there any interpretation of this cutting?
Yes. Good. In the gauge theory, okay, so let's think, because that's interesting, so let's think a little bit about what this cutting is in the gauge theory at weak coupling. So at weak coupling, I draw the same picture, except that because it's a discrete operator, I put some lines to indicate the various fields of this operator. So this would be an operator of length 4, 9. And then there are another operator here of length, say, 5, and another operator here of some length that I will figure out when I start drawing the lines. And then what do we start doing? We start contracting these operators and doing just weak contractions and connecting these operators. And we connect something like this, and then like this. And the rest we connect here. Bunch of more lines here, for example. And now we see that indeed, if I thought that these operators, that it had some excitations that were moving around, right? Now these excitations, when I cut it, I split my operator of length L1, or in that notation it was L3. I split it into this number, which would be L23, if this is operator 2 and this is operator 1. And this would be L13, these partial lengths of these propagators. And in the gauge theory, I would see this inner triangle here. I would call it the hexagon in the front. And the outer triangle here, I would call it the hexagon in the back. Let me take this opportunity to mention something related to Ehon's comment about this suppression here. This suppression was the propagation of particle, and it was suppressed exponential of minus the mass times the length of the particle. What is that in gauge theory? How does a particle propagate in gauge theory? It propagates by interacting. So, for example, an example of a particle propagating around some length, a particle propagating like this. In gauge theory terms, I would describe it, for example, by saying I have a bunch of propagators from top to bottom. And what does it mean for the particle to propagate? It would be, for example, some gluon that it goes around. And you see, because it's planar, it needs to interact a bunch of times till it feels, till it goes all the way around. You get it? So you want some interaction, something that flows and goes around. So it could be, for example, some gluon interactions that goes around like this. It doesn't need to be gluon interaction. It could be, for example, I can replace this by some quartic interaction. But what I want to say is that if I have length L, I need L interactions to take place because they are planar. I cannot just interact this guy and go around and interact again. Because I am on the plane, or on the cylinder in this case, I need to do a sequence of L of them. And each of them, each of these interactions, would give me something like G square, the coupling. And then, as we said, we have to do L of them. And so this gives E to the minus log of G square, or log of 1 over G square, times L. This quantity here is the mass of the particle. If you interpret the mass of this mirror particle, this quantity here is how you would interpret the mass of this mirror particle at weak coupling. And this will tell you that these effects there, they are suppressed at weak coupling by this usual Boltzmann suppression factor, e to the minus the mass times the length, which in this weak coupling becomes just coupling to the length. And now when I'm doing here these three-point functions, you could ask, when does the front hexagon and back hexagon know about each other? And they know about each other once the front and the back start communicating with each other. I need a particle to travel from the front to the back. And what length does this particle need to propagate before it sees that there is an hexagon in the back? It needs to propagate now this effect. And so the finite size effects here they would be of the type e to the minus m times this partial length Lij. It is just that the topology now is not a circle where I go by length L. It's a pair of pans where I have three different relevant lengths. And therefore, I would have this effect, or at weak coupling, g squared to the power Lij. This is when finite size effects kick in. What it means is that before finite size effects, so for example, if these lengths are 10, only at 10 loops do I need these finite size effects that couple front and back. Before 10 loops, the hexagons are effectively decoupled. And all you need to know is which particles are in the front, which particles are in the back, and that's it. They are decoupled otherwise. Like in the spectrum, if the length is 10, then this only shows up at 10 loops for the first meter particle. And then all you need to know is about the physical momentum of the particle. Okay. So if the length is 10, you just need to know what is the physical momentum of the particles, unless you care about 10 loops or 12 loops, and then you need the quantum effect. Okay, so let me now write some, what are then the formulas that give us this physical momentum? So what we want to go now is understand, so let's drop all these exponentially suppressed effects. And let's focus on this physical momentum Pj. Okay? Because now it's all we need. For the spectrum, I just need to know what they are and sum their energies. And for the three-point functions, I just need to know what they are and sum over ways of splitting them into groups. Because then for each group, I have this hexagon object that I also know. Okay, so let's focus on this piece. So if I have a particle, let's first remind ourselves, if I have just a particle on a circle, and I have a single particle on a circle of length L, what do we say? We say that the momentum of this particle is quantized, and the quantization is this. In other words, the momentum is just an integer in units of 2 pi n over L. Right? And this just tells you that the wave function should be periodic. If I take the particle and carry it around the ring, I should go back to myself, and therefore this momentum must be quantized. So that's the obvious equation for a single particle on a circle, right? Now, and then what would you do? You would quantize the momentum, and then you would say the energy, if it's some quantum mechanic example, it would be p squared over twice the mass of the particle, where the momentum is this discretized level. An integrable theory is a theory where this condition is modified, but in a mild way. It's modified in a way that we can still work with. And it becomes as follows. You think that now I don't have one particle only. I have many particles on a circle. And so this particle, Pj, is quantized not just the particle going around, the total phase is 1. But now when the particle goes around and comes back, as it goes around, it can meet the other particles. And therefore, the equation is no longer just 1 equal to exponential of momentum of particle times length. There is an extra term, which is whenever it meets another particle, k not equal to j, there is an extra phase, and that's called S matrix. And these are called beta equations. And this S, in our case, is basically extracted out of this tensor that I mentioned, S that I said was known at all values of the cup. And so this gives us a quantization of the momentum. Solving these equations, each solution of this equation would give you a set of momentum. So given these equations, I get a set of a solution, a set of momentum, and then my energy is just the sum of the energy of this momentum plus finite size corrections that we are dropping today. Now, this equation here, this is called Beat equation, and I hope the physical meaning is clear. It's a very important equation for us. It's the equation that describes the exact spectrum, for at least for large lengths, of this operator. And it's an equation that we often solve by putting this equation in a computer, for example, and solve this equation when I have a bunch of particles. Let's call the number of particles S. If I have S excitations on some spin chain of length L, I would solve this coupled set of S equations, get a set of momenta, plug them into the energy, and get the spectrum of the system. Now, this equation, this Beat equation, is equivalent to another equation, which is called Baxter equation. Or sometimes it is equivalent. And for our case that we are discussing, that we'll be discussing now, which is when I'm considering weak coupling, these equations are equivalent. So this is probably the most important equation I'm going to write today. So let me write it down. And it will look totally different from these Beat equations. And then we have to understand, and it's not complicated, to see why would they be at all related? Why is it the same thing? Because they really look very different. So the equation is the following. You have a function Q, that's the key object that you want to solve for. And the equation says that Q of U plus I times U plus I over 2 to the length, to the power of the length, plus the complex conjugate, namely Q of U minus I times U minus I over 2 to the L, minus T of U times Q of U is equal to 0. So this Q and this T, for today, they are polynomials. And the claim is that these equations, solving these equations, finding solutions of these equations for polynomial T and polynomial Q, is the same as solving this quantization condition for particles in a circle for a particular important class of S matrices S. Okay. So why would it be at all the same, and how do we establish the connection? So let me just explain this simple thing. So the idea is the following. Suppose I take my momentum, Pj, and I define, let's define Q of U, this is definition, as a product of U minus Uj, and I make a product up to S, where these Uj are basically the momentum Pj of the excitations, but in a cleverly parametrization. Namely, Uj is 1/2 of cotangent of Pj over 2. So knowing the Pj is knowing the Uj. But I just wrote it like this because it turns out to be a clever choice. So U's and P's are roughly the same. Now, so this is a definition. Now the claim is that this equation is true. And let's see what we would be able to tell about this equation. First, now we see that this polynomial has degree S. This polynomial T must have degree L, where L is the size of the spin chain, because this has degree S plus L. Okay, so this has degree L, this has degree S. Now, if I evaluate this equation at U equal to Uj, so let's take this equation and evaluate it at U equal to Uj, what do we get? We get that the last term is 0. U of Uj is equal to 0, because U is product of U minus Uj. And so we get that this term is equal to this term. In other words, we get that the first two terms are equal, that I will write in the following way. I will say that 1 is equal to minus the ratio of the two terms. So 1 is equal to uj plus I over 2 divided by uj minus I over 2 to the power L times a factor which is minus q of uj plus I over q of uj minus I. Right? Do you agree? Now, with this definition of u, you can easily see why this definition of u was a clever choice. Because with this definition of u, this factor here, that's why, where the u came from, this factor here is nothing but exponential of I times pj to the power L, which is e to the I pj times L. So this combination here in the parentheses, when you plug u to be 1/2 cotangent, is nothing but e to the ip. And therefore, this factor here becomes just the momentum of the particle going around. So that's exactly the first term that I had in bit equations. And what about the second term? While this second term here, let's see what it becomes. This second term, let's write it that this is nothing but the product. Q is a product, so nothing but the product over K with a minus sign in front of uj minus uk plus I over uj minus uk minus I. Right? I just put the uk that was here, here. And now it turns out that this combination here, first look, there is a minus sign, but there is a product over all k's. So if I put k not equal to j, I can put a plus sign here. Right? That because when uj is equal to uk, this gives minus 1. So I can get rid of that minus sign. And then I recognize perfectly a product like this, provided the S matrix is identified with this factor here. So this quantity here is nothing but the S matrix with momentum, or with rapidity in this case, uj and uk. So this is nothing but the scattering of these two excitations. And in the case that I'm describing, this works when these excitations are these derivatives. If you remember, I had derivative scalars, a bunch of different excitations. When they are just these derivatives moving, they scatter precisely with this factor.
So we see that solving this Baxter equation is equivalent to solving this bit equation. So we have two alternative ways of finding the spectrum. Either you solve, solving a set of coupled equations for numbers, pj, you solve this equation. If you prefer to solve functional equations for polynomials, that here is a set of functional equations, find polynomials that obey this functional equation, you solve this set of equations. Then if you know the polynomials, you can get the zeros of the polynomials and from them the energy. Similarly, if you solve these equations, then you can construct the polynomials by just multiplying the zeros, multiplying the solutions to this equation. So you can go from one to the other as you wish. But this is a compact way of, instead of finding the individual momentum, you find this polynomial that has the information of all the momentum. Let me mention that this Baxter equation is a bit like a Schrödinger equation, where this term here, this first term here, would be the analog of some derivative of my wave function, where q is the analog of my wave function. So this is like some discrete derivative of my wave function. And then this is equal to the wave function again. So this t is the analog of potential minus energy. This term would be potential times the energy times the wave function.
And quantum mechanics, we are used to finding the wave function and the energy. You solve the equation and you find the wave function and the energy. Here, it's a bit funny. You see that you solve this equation and you find the wave function, the energy, and the potential. We solve, now we found everything, now we have Q, we plug Q here, we get T. And so the potential itself, T, that we don't know a priori what it is fixed self-consistently. In other words, it's a Schrödinger-like problem where the potential comes automatically out of solving the equation. And how could it work? It works because it has this extra important assumption that we are dealing with polynomials. So we are saying, solve Schrödinger equation in the space of polynomials. Then the potential is automatically fixed for you because you impose that the potential is also polynomial. But it's kind of a fun problem where you are solving some discrete version of Schrödinger equation, finding the potential and the wave functions at the same time. Now, once you have this solution, let's see that, you see, we work with Q that is given, that's a polynomial, but of course, I don't need to write Q like this. I can write Q as sum of Cn u to the n, and all the information is in the UJs, but it's also in the Cn's. So it's really up to us. How do we solve? How do we prefer to encode the physical state? Do we want to encode as the zeros of Q or as the coefficients of the polynomial? Up to us. And then we have a nice formula for the energy, and the energy is in terms of the roots. So it would be nice if we could write a formula for the energy that would not care about the particular representation of the polynomial. And that is really just a function of the polynomial. I give you the polynomial and you compute the energy. And of course such formula exists, and I'm going to write it down, and it's the following. Delta is just 2i times the derivative of the polynomial at I over 2 divided by the polynomial at I over 2. It's just plus complex function. So how does this work? It's very simple, actually. This, you see, what I'm writing here is nothing but the derivative with respect to u of log of the Baxter function q, that's what u prime over q is, right? At u equals y over 2. But this is just equal log of q. Q is a product, so this is just the sum of 1 over u minus uj when u is equal to y over 2. So if you work out the algebra, you see that this is nothing but the sum of 2 divided by uj squared plus 1 quarter. And if you compute this quantity, this is 8 sine squared of p over 2, which is the energy of particles on a quantum spin shape, where you just have hopping to the left and to the right, and you get this typical sine squared of p for the movement of the particle to the left or to the right. So this is the correct energy that you expect. So the energy that you get as a sum of individual energies of the spin chain, I can indeed write it, forgetting about what these q's are, as a simple function of the q's, like we promised before. There is a q, and I just compute some simple action on this q, where q solves this equation. I can forget about particles, about scattering, about anything. You just say, I have a functional equation, which is my Baxter equation q. I solve it, and I plug it into the simple functional to get the energy of my state, or the energy of my operator in n equals 4.
I have a simple question. Do you also have the other Baxter equation that T is expressed as a bilinear of Q's?
So there are many other relations for Q functions. In particular, you can ask how do I find T explicitly and so on, and in terms of the Q's, and I'm not using it here, and it's an interesting question of whether that is going to be useful later, but for now, let's not use it. But these kind of things are the kind of things that Paul will talk a lot about.
So you mentioned that this equivalence works at weak coupling. Why was that?
Good. Because it's at weak coupling that the momentum is just given that this parameterization of the momentum and the S-matrix works. The S-matrix is equal to this at-weak coupling. As I go to finite coupling, this function here gets corrections. Then I will need to correct this Baxter equation and replace it to something else. That something else is the quantum spectral curve. So this is perfect for spin chains, rational spin chains they are called, because the S-matrix is a rational function. As we go to n equals 4 and we start turning on the interactions, the way to derivative scatter is not just this, it's this plus corrections. Then the corrections need to be incorporated. The first few orders you can still do it in this language. But as you go to many, many loops or to finite coupling, the best way is not to use this Baxter equation, but to use some better version of it, which is the quantum spectral curve, which is in speed more closely related to what Kevin was asking.
So to all orders in perturbation theory, does this structure exist?
We don't know exactly. Probably it can be made, this structure exists until you get finite size corrections. That probably is safe to say. Beyond finite size corrections, whether there's an effective Baxter equation that incorporates finite size corrections automatically, there are some examples where this is known and the answer is yes in that case. I think in the third lecture of Paul he will give an example.
Is there an easy way to understand in the other physical side why these Qs are polynomials? Or like why is it reasonable to restrict to polynomials?
Okay, so here Q was defined as just a polynomial whose zeros are the momentum, so it was by definition, right, a polynomial. Now, there is another way of understanding, which is when you understand what's the physical definition of this t and this q. T, here we wrote an equation for functions, but this equation could be written at operator level. I could put hats on all these operators. And then this would be operators, and t would be an operator. And this operator T is called transfer matrix. And the transfer matrix is a product of R matrices. And this object here, T, we will draw it as some object that scatters with all physical sides, 1 up to L. And each scattering is what's called an R matrix. And this R matrix is a rational object. So then it becomes clear that this T should be a polynomial or a rational, yeah, polynomial. Then once T is a polynomial, it's natural to look for solutions that are polynomial for this equation. Q would also be defined as an operator, and then you would also see that at weak coupling Q is a polynomial. When you go beyond weak coupling, this definition of this object as operator, we don't know. We don't know exactly what is the transfer matrix and finite coupling and so on. So it's often the case in n equals 4 that there are many things that we know how to do at operator level at very weak coupling. Then we convert them to eigenvalues. And then we guess the whole loop generalization. But we don't know the operator version of the whole loop generalization. That's very common. It often happens that we know how to do things rigorously at weak coupling and prove everything and make everything into theorems where you derive everything and everything is super sharp. And then when you go to finite coupling, you have guesses. That's very, very common.
One observation. So yeah, there are models where T is rational because the R matrix is still rational, but you cannot look for Q in the space of polynomials. So I think it's rather related to the type of representation that define your Hilbert space. Because here you have highest weight representation, but that's not the case in general.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Q, yeah, the class of Q depends on the representation, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, a related point is that if you do what Pedro was saying and build all of these things as operators, then indeed the space of functions which you would be looking at would automatically be dictated by representation theory, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the remaining 5 minutes, So if you remember in the schedule, it was 1 hour 15 each part, so I'm not over time. And I will be on time. So let me then tell you now. So we have this UJs. How does this formula that I wrote schematically look like with more factors written more explicitly? And let me write it in the case where one operator has excitation, but the others do not. So let's have two operators that are boring, if you want. They have just vacuum. And this operator breaks into two. And because it breaks into two, like we said, this object is proportional to a sum over ways of breaking these physical particles that are the solutions, the zeros of this Baxter polynomial, into two groups, the one that end up in the front and the ones that end up in the back. Now, this formula, the way it was first computed, we computed it several years ago, it was written in the following way. And this is the result of just doing combinatorics. We just wrote the space at weak coupling, like I was drawing here, and Kevin asked, how does it look at weak coupling? And we just did the combinatorics, writing the various states, contracting them, summing over all possible weak contractions, and we got this formula. So the formula I'm going to write, it doesn't come from hexagons or anything, it just comes from doing weak contractions and doing the combinatorics. And then I'll write a formula that we will then look at the formula and try to see where are the hexagons, how can it be, why does it want to be interpreted with hexagons. But the way it was derived was just doing weak contractions. And the formula was the following at weak coupling. It was a sum. Then there was some stupid sign that we don't care, minus one to the number of elements in the partition alpha bar. Then there was a product over the elements in alpha bar uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the small l, where this small l is the length here. Remember, each operator we break into these lij's, so let this be l, and this length here would be capital L minus small l. And then there was a sum over partitions with a factor like this for the partition alpha bar. And then there was a product over alpha and alpha bar, j in alpha and k in alpha bar, of a simple function, 1 plus I over uj minus uk. This was a function we called f of uj uk. Now, when you look at this equation, what do you see? You see that you take your particles and you break it into two groups. And then you have some factor that looks like propagation, but only for one group. And then it looks like you have the two groups interacting with each other with this interaction strength F. Right? So it doesn't look exactly like what I was saying before, that I have particles in the front decoupled from particles in the back. Look more or less the extreme opposite, right? We have a sum over interactions between two groups. It doesn't look very much like one group in the front, one group in the back. And so the key is to think, so the idea is that we have to think a little bit more about this equation. And let's think about this equation to show you how it works. Let's think that we have an example of just two particles. Let's write it down, let's spell it out carefully for two particles, meaning that our set of particles has two elements, u1 and u2. Then what would this formula be equal to? It would be equal to, if alpha is the full set, then it is just 1. 1 is when alpha is the full set. When alpha is u1 and alpha bar is u2, I will write that case. So this is alpha equal to the full set, u1, u2, and alpha bar is the empty set. Now let's write alpha equal to u1, and alpha bar is therefore u2. So that case will give me, okay, there's a minus sign, and then it gives me u2 plus I over 2 over U2 minus I over 2 to the L. No, times this function f, 1, 2. You understand the notation, right? F1, 2 is just it's obvious, right? It's f of U1, U2. Then there is the case where alpha is U2 and alpha bar is U1. And that will give me a similar factor with U1. And finally, there are both alpha bar is the full thing, then there is no interaction again, and there is just plus this product u1 plus I over 2, u1 minus I over 2 to the L, and the same thing for u2. Okay. So now, let's note something. So let's write this stuff. Let me write it, let me factor out F12. And then, and let me introduce some, let me point out something, that remember this factor here was nothing but exponential of I times momentum of particle 1, right? And because of the power L times L. Right? So now that I factor out F21 and use this shorthand, not shorthand, this better notation, I get 1 over F12, let me write it in a convenient way that will be clear in 1 second, times 1, that's the first term. The second term is minus, I remove F12, so now I get e to the I, P2 times L, times 1, which I write as 1 times 1. Then the next term, I factor out F12, so I get minus, minus e to the I P1 times L times F21 over F12 times 1 times 1. And the last term I write plus 1 times 1 over F12. And it comes with a factor e to the I P1 plus P2 times up. So now let's interpret and see what's going on here. The claim, now the interpretation becomes much more clear. What's happening is the following. Here we are, what we have is that both parts you have, that you cut it into two hexagons, and alpha bar was empty, so there's nothing on the second hexagon, and both particles are on the same hexagon. Okay, then it seems like you interpret this object as the hexagon expectation value with two particles U1 and U2. You should just call it 1 over F12. What about here? And this was particle 1 and this was particle 2. What about here? Here, what happens is that now alpha is particle 1 and the particle 2 moves here, and now particle 2 is here. Particle 2 is in the back. This was alpha equal u1 and alpha bar equal u2. But you see, particle 2 moves to the back. When it moves to the back, it picks a propagation factor. Because particle 2, that was here, say, moves to the back. And it moved to the back, it passed by some length L. So it picked the propagation factor e to the IPL. So that's perfect. What about this term here? This term here, now we have that now particle 2 is here, and particle 1 was the one that was here and moved here. And now particle 1 is here. So what do we get? we get a propagation because now particle 1 propagates. But now particle 1 to propagate needs to pass by particle 2. And so we pick this extra factor. But now look, what is this factor? This function f, what happens when I do f21 divided by f12? This stuff cancels and I get u minus u plus I over u minus u minus I. That's exactly what we said was the S-matrix. Right? If you remember, that's what is here, that this factor was precisely the S-matrix of the particles. So this factor here is nothing but the scattering of particle 2 when it passes by particle, or particle 1 when it passes by particle 2 to go to the other exit. Finally, we have the last term, where the first hexagon is empty, that's why there's a 1, and the second hexagon has both particles. And now both just moved at the same time, so there was no need for anything to cross, they just moved. And that's why there is this factor. So this works for many particles, and what looks like a maximally entangled stuff, you can realize that it becomes maximally factorized up to these propagation factors that those where things are, that things have to move from the back to the front.
So there should be an Arnold formula where you have capital L minus small l, and you go from alpha bar to alpha, I guess.
Great question. So Enrico is asking, it looks like going to the right was privileged. Why couldn't you go to the left and write a similar formula going to the left? And indeed, you could. And what's the difference? Why would it not make a difference? Because of the quantization condition. The quantization condition tells you that E to the I, for example, for this particular case, P1 times capital L times S12 equal to 1, because we have two particles only. And that allows you, using this equation, if you write this L as L minus L plus small l, of flipping exponentials that have small l to exponentials that have capital L minus small l. In other words, going in one side, you get some factor, going in the other side, you get another factor, but you know that going around the full thing was trivial. And so you can convert this formula from going to the right, a right-moving formula, to a left-moving formula, and they are, of course, equivalent. So, this, then the claim, so the claim is that this f that started its life as something very simple, 1 plus I over u minus b, we know it at all loops. We can write 1 plus g squared, first correction, uv plus dot dot dot. So this, we know this structure, this construction, basically exact. All that changes is this f and the relation to the momentum. And so we have this formulation where we can compute three-point functions at all loops. But let me just mention, in concluding, so what do we use it for right now? So the punchline right now is the following. So we have a formula for the structure constant C123, which is equal to gluing of hexagons. And by this formula, we understand what we mean. There are lots of sums and integrals involved. Because of all these sums and integrals, this is doable but hard. So in practice, people have pushed this program as far as 5 loops, which is a lot. You need to correct f to many loops, you need to start putting meter corrections, not many, but a few meter corrections. Why not many? Because of this exponential suppression that I mentioned. But it works well. The big advantage is that, first, it's very physical. You really see the particles moving. You can imagine in your head you cut things, and things are in the front or in the back. For some things, it's very good. For example, if you are dealing with spin chains of various lengths, the lengths just enter as simple parameters, so it's a very convenient formula to changing just lengths and working. For some things, it's terrible. So let me give you just, let me just mention two things for which this would be really terrible. So one very simple thing you could study, you could ask, is what is the three-point function between the lightest string state and two gravitons? So you could ask at strong coupling, I want to consider the two-point function between two lightest gravitons, they are called these 20 prime operators. They are basically trace of z squared, the smallest possible operator that you can have. And here you would have the first massive string state that would be, that's the so-called Kanishi state. So Kanishi is an example of a state that has, in the language I've been using, length equal to 2 and 2 excitations. So it's a very small state. So because it's very small, it's the smallest it could be. You have a very small state with 2 excitations there. Finite size corrections are super important. You cannot just double. And you are doing strong coupling. So this is totally unachievable by this method. So this is an example that this is impossible to compute. I mean, it's really, it would require resumming everything, and there's no simple way of approaching this from this. It's a very simple example of a very important quantity. It's the light, it's the decay of the lightest massive state into two massless states. Right? So it's one of the most, the simplest quantities you could ask at strong coupling. So great as it might be, it fails for this particular example, one part. Another example where it would fail miserably, this technique, or maybe not miserably, but just it would fail, which is, suppose I want to study, for example, the three-point function between an operator O and two scalar operators, and this operator has S derivatives, where S is the spin. And suppose I want to study this function of the spin when the spin is complex. So I want to analytically continue and study complex spin. Now, you see, the example we were discussing here was spin 2. I had 2 excitations, and they could be in the front, in the back, and I have 4 turns because 4 is 2 squared, and these 2 spins can be in the front, in the back, one in the front, one in the back. Now imagine spin is 2.3. What does it mean? To have 2.3 particles, and to sum over ways of splitting 2.3 particles in front and back. How would we even try to approach this problem of a solving? And you see that such things should exist, because this Baxter polynomial, this Baxter approach, I can solve Baxter for complex spin, and I can find solutions of Baxter for complex spin, and I can study Baxter with complex spin. In other words, this is not yet at the stage where I can say that you just give me 3 solutions of Baxter and I get an answer. That's not yet of this form here. So such formulation, where you give me 3 Baxter functions and I give you a number, could have some advantages over this. It could help understand these problems of analytic continuations. It could help solve these problems that finite size corrections are crucial or not. And so discussing what we know about trying to develop this formulation where given 3 Qs we get a number is what I'm going to describe in the last lecture. And from that point of view, we will use this hexagon as like an oracle. It's a machine that produces data. It tells us what results should be for three-point functions, up to many loops. And then we have this data and we want to recast it in a more elegant way. And the punchline is not going to be that this is better than this or this is better than this. It will be that this is very good for some things and this is very good for some things, and they have some overlapping regimes where both are good and some regimes where one is much better than the other. And while this we know at all loops, this so far we only know at the first few loops. And my hope is that after Paul's mini course, we might together understand how to improve this and have a solution for loops. Okay, I did go 10 minutes over time, sorry.